Good morning. This meeting is now in session. My name is Angela Ryder, and I am the chair of the Arizona State Board of Massage Therapy. It is Monday, June 26, 2023 at 9:03 a.m., and I'm calling this meeting to order. Folks on this video conference, please mute yourselves until it is your opportunity to speak, or you have been called upon to eliminate distractions of background noise. The chair of the Arizona State Board of Massage Therapy reserves the right to change the order of items published on this agenda, except for public hearings set for a specific time. During the board meeting and upon a vote of the majority of the quorum, the board may go into executive session to obtain legal advice from the board's attorneys pursuant to ARS 38-431.03A3 on any items listed on the agenda. All meeting attendees whose presence is not required in executive session may remain in the boardroom when the board withdraws to chambers for an executive session. Any and all legal action by the board members will only take place in open session. Director Alberton, will you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Board Member Tapscott?
Present.
Vice Chair Moon?
Present.
Board Member DeRoost? Chair Ryder?
Present.
Three present, one absent, one vacancy.
Thank you. Item number three is a call to public pursuant to ARS 38-431.01H. The board may make an open call to public during a public meeting, which is subject to a reasonable time. The cutoff time is 2 minutes and will be timed by the board staff. Place and manner restrictions to allow individuals to address the public body on any issues that is within the jurisdiction of the public body. However, members of the board are not allowed to discuss or take legal action on matters raised during an open call to public unless the matters are properly noticed for discussion and legal action. The board, however, may ask staff to review a matter or may ask that the matter be put on a future agenda. Please be advised, a call to public is not an opportunity for testimony for cases that are being reviewed by the board, and again, must be within the jurisdiction of the public body. Do we have a call to public? And it appears that we do not.
Hello?
Yes.
Are you calling for attendees?
No, we are not. We are doing a call to public.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda, item number four, declaration of board member conflicts of interest. Board members should have had an opportunity to review the board packet sent out by the staff. Are there any conflicts of interest regarding any of the cases or investigative reviews that we're conducting today? Board Member Tapscott.
Yes, this is Board Member Tapscott. I do have a conflict of interest. I need to recuse myself from case number 23-035A.
Thank you very much. Since we will not have a quorum because of your recusal, board staff, I would like to move that case to our next meeting, please.
That's confirmed, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Item number five on the agenda, we have received the open meeting minutes to review. Yes, Mr. Tapscott.
I'm so sorry. I see that individual on this call that's involved in that case. I'm assuming they're released from being at this meeting.
That would be correct.
I just didn't want them to think they had to wait.
Yes, thank you for that clarification.
Thank you.
Item number five on the agenda, we've received the open meeting minutes to review from our meeting on May 22, 2023. Are there any questions or discussions to be had regarding these open meeting minutes?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Before you call for the vote, if you're looking at the amended agenda, there'll be two sets of minutes.
Correct. I was going to do that separately, if that's
okay.
All right.
I apologize. I wanted to make sure everybody knew that there was an amended agenda.
Yes. Thank you so much. I move to accept these open meeting minutes from May 22nd, 2023. Do I have a second?
This is Board Member Tapscott. I second that.
And board members, we shall do a voice vote to approve these minutes. Please unmute, beginning with Vice Chair Moon. State your name and voice your approval or opposition.
Vice Chair Moon, aye.
Board Member Tapscott, aye.
Chair Ryder, aye. The motion passes to approve these minutes for May 22nd, 2023. We also need to repeat the approval minute, meeting minutes from March 27th, 2023, as I had gotten a second but did not do a voice vote with that, with those meeting minutes. So with a voice vote today on June 26, 2023, I move to approve the open meeting minutes from March 27th, 2023. Do I have a second?
This is Board Member Taps. Can I second that motion?
And again, a voice vote from the board members for approval or opposition.
Vice Chair Moon, aye.
I don't believe we had a second. Did I miss the second?
Yeah, this is Board Member Tapscott. I did second that motion.
Okay, thank you.
And this is Board Member Tapscott. I say aye to that motion.
And Chair Ryder, aye. The motion passes to accept the meeting minutes from March 27, 2023. Item number 6 on the agenda, we have to review a readoption of the state massage board policy regarding providing discretionary authority for board's executive director to close investigative cases without board agendizing an action. The reason that we're doing this is because the recording of this adoption of 12-22-2022, the meeting, the recording had failed, so it was not on record. So we do need to vote on that again. So as a clarification, the motion is, and I move, that the Arizona State Board of Massage Therapy grants discretionary authority to its executive director to administratively close those board investigations which will not proceed for adjudication in public session by the board. The reasons would include factual insufficiency, lack of statutory jurisdiction or relevance to the board's regulatory authority following written submission of public complaints, investigation by the board investigator, and consultation with the signed attorney general.
Vice Chair Moon, I'll second that.
And can we do a roll call vote on this motion, please?
Yes, ma'am, sure. Vice Chair Moon?
Aye.
Board Member Tapscott?
Aye.
Chair Ryder?
Aye.
Three ayes, one absent.
The motion passes. Item number 7 on the agenda, I'd like to cover some clarification points of licensing procedures. And this is for public, this is for board members, this is for license holders. These are some things that we've noticed over the last few months that have needed some clarification. And I would like to, once I've completed my speech here, I will open up the floor for additional comments from the other board members. So first of all, it's important to understand the jurisdiction of the board, and it is important to know that your board only has one license processor, and between the license processor and the executive director, they receive on average about 70 to 110 phone calls and another 100 emails each day, overwhelming them with information that can be found regularly on the website, and it does take away from the work that could be done for others. Repeating emails over and over again, expecting a different answer each time, is wasting precious time that could be used elsewhere. Mondays are the highest number of inquiries. All calls and emails are time-stamped and researched and responded to in the order of receipt, so they are not being ignored. That being said, it is unnecessary to continue to ask the same question over and over and demanding an immediate response. While the board's primary function of existence is to protect the public, there are times the board is called upon to protect the license holder, and the license holders are also members of the public. Times like this would be when a license holder is put into danger, such as in the workplace. License holders are part of the public as well. The board is not legally obligated to engage with third parties regarding someone's license. While many schools assist individuals with initial applications, once the application is submitted, the board can only communicate outcomes and processing of those applications with the individual who wishes to obtain the license. The same is true for non-English speaking individuals. The board cannot speak with husbands or wives or other family members about the license, only the license holder or applicant. In order for the board to serve the license holders in the best way possible, the license holders need to update their information on the board website. License holders need to visit the board site regularly to keep up to date with changes. And we do get many communications about clarification of wording on the website, and we are open to those suggestions and have taken those suggestions seriously and updated language on the website. Many people have no idea what is happening in their own industry and haven't for quite some time. A great example of this is when the board's Adobe software was updated and required license holders to upload their 24 hours of CEs. Hundreds of license holders had no idea that they even needed continuing education and had been practicing for more than a decade without taking continuing education classes. Another example of this is license holders who have been unaware that the 12 CE hours are in person and 12 can be done online. This has been a law since the board's inception, and the law had never changed. The board had requested adjustments and was allowed to make changes for license holders during COVID to aid the license holders financially, such as waiving the continuing education requirements for one renewal cycle and also waiving renewal fees for one cycle. Since the mandates have been lifted, everything has been returned to what has always been the law. The State Board has not increased its number of employees in the last 10 years and had more staff historically than in the present. For example, the board used to have 3 investigators and now only has 1. The board has the same computer database now as it has had when it converted from paper to computer in 2010. But the computer database, it is still designed on a laptop and is all manual. The board is now electronic to paper. When an applicant submits a digital application, it must have every letter and every number manually entered on the board's licensing database. Nothing is automatic, and it cannot produce any self-analytical reports. Payments for initial and renewal applications are electronic and must be done through the payment portal when filling out the application. Do not send a photocopy of your debit or credit card. The State Board has 1 licensing employee, 1 investigator, and 1 telephone customer service person. There is no cross-trained staff or staff to relieve one another for sickness leave or vacation leave. There is no dedicated staff person to respond to school inquiries, and most student affairs offices have more staff available than the entire board. A minimum of 3 months is needed to obtain an Arizona State massage license because of the required national criminal background check, which takes about 70 to 90 days for the board to receive after the fingerprints have been submitted. HB 2348 from 2022 now requires all licensed massage therapists to have a level 1 DPS clearance card. You need it for renewal and will need to provide DPS inked fingerprints to obtain that card. This card will expire every 6 years, and the process will have to be repeated with DPS. Schools are encouraged to empower their students to apply for these well before graduation. This will help the schools determine if the individuals will qualify for Arizona state licensure in the first place and will offer ample time for good faith exemptions when needed. After almost 2 years, the state board continues to have a seat vacancy. The board has 5 seats and must have 3 members in attendance to constitute a legal quorum to conduct business. The last state board, before each of us had arrived, had the same challenge with seats open for months to years. The state board has 2 sets for industry representatives and 3 seats for representatives of the public. The current vacancy is for a public member. Letters of interest are submitted online to the governor's office. So if anybody in the public would like to be considered for that seat, please fill out the application. The most recent sunset audit only provides a 2-year legislative extension to the state board, which will be audited again in 18 months. Without new legislation, the board will cease to operate in 2 years. This recently happened to the state funeral board, which was also transferred to the Arizona Department of Health Services. In earlier years, sunset legislation, when approved, would restore a state agency for 8 to 10 years. Arizona used to provide licensee photographs on massage therapy license, but the practice was defunded. So now we just have names. We don't have photographs to go with those names. It also should be known that there is discussion underway coming to the board to increase all the board's licensing fees, and that will definitely be coming up for discussion in future meetings as well. That is my entire speech. So board members, board member Tapscott, Vice Chair Moon, if you have any comments or questions, please feel free.
Yeah, this
Vice Chair Moon, I have no addition. I think you did very well of packaging all of that. And again, I strongly encourage people to communicate, but make sure that they're doing their due diligence and researching and going on our website before they overload our staff. Thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Tapscott.
Thank you. 2 questions. One is the phone calls, which the board is inundated with very little staff. I can't even imagine. But so they're time stamped. How far on average are we backlogged? Does that make sense? Like, how long does it take us on average to catch? We never catch up, but how many days behind are we on returning phone calls, for example?
I'll defer that to Director Augerton.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Board Member Tapscott, good question. With phone calls, the primary problem is sufficiency of access to the one person. So while he is on a telephone call responding to someone, which requires initial research off the database, 2 or 3 more calls may come in at the same time.
Sure.
They are then put into a recording device, and if they do not leave an email address and a license number and things like that, sometimes not even a phone number, then we have no ability to call them back. What does speed things up is the individual answering phones will attempt to summarize what the person's calling about and put that in an email, which goes into InfoBox. And then we respond from InfoBox, looking up the email address of the person calling. During an average day, we also get walk-ins, and we'll have multiple walk-ins to the lobby to Windows 6, but Windows 6 as a receptionist does not have the ability to respond for the board. So then those individuals contact us as well, and we have a separate list of responding for them. In many cases, individuals are dropping off. On the emails lately, because of the DPS Level 1 card, we're operating data like this morning. I haven't checked numbers yet, but we're operating with unanswered emails between 50 and 70, and we attempt to go in order of the first arrived and not the most recent. But it's kind of catch-as-catch-can. It's a triage process with the walk-ins, the phone calls, and then the emails. The other thing, too, is individuals calling are not really after a quick piece of information. They're typically checking on the status of their initial application, which does take up to 3 months to process, and they're checking to see if a specific transcript came in or a photograph or several things like that. So each of these have to be looked up and researched before an answer can be given. So I would say, being candid, we don't do an adequate job of responding to what the public's needs are at that moment. The only thing I can tell you folks is that we have prioritized renewal processing first and foremost. Because individuals that are currently employed, and unfortunately nobody submits within the 60-day window prior to expiration, and we get applications up to the last day and even on the day of expiration. But that would be the first priority, because without a renewal, a person can't work. But with the level one card and individuals not knowing about the level one card, many people think they've done a renewal by paying without filling out the application, attaching the CE certificates and so forth. So there, in many cases, is a 2-week downtime from someone who thought they were done with their renewal and then have to run to DPS to get the level one card. I guess the only good news in any of this is that the DPS folks continue to amaze with their turnaround time with the level one cards for people that are LMTs. If you already have a level one card, then all you have to do is to update your license with the massage board with DPS. But if you're applying for the first time and you provide prints and a completed application, they're coming back under 2 weeks. Now, it doesn't satisfy the person who now is inactive and can't work for a week or two, but that's kind of the battlefield condition right now. It's not orderly, and it's not logical, and it's not resourced appropriately. And I guess if you want any other good news, is the state of Arizona has made a decision to completely transfer over to a new database called Femtia. And I guess depending on your age, you'll either like this or you won't. If you're like myself, over a certain age, and you've done a medical portal in the last couple of years, you will probably find the Femtia experience painful. If you're younger than me, which is most of the population, then you will find this to be of great ease, because you can use technology to put your information in and be done, depending on your skill level, within a day. So that's the future of this and other boards going to the new database. And in theory, and hopefully in quick practice later this year, this process will be improved and shortened. But right now, it is Lucy and Ethel in the chocolate factory and the conveyor belt that goes to.
Thank you. Thank you for the three of us that understand that reference. definitely me. No, I think you're doing a great job triaging. In fact, I myself got my license renewed. I don't even know how fast, 24 hours, 12 hours, something. It was amazing. And I think your priority is in the right order. But are you saying we don't actually know how backlogged we are because you're so understaffed and it's such a high volume?
Well, I mean, we can always give you real-time numbers. And I'm not looking at that right now because I'm on this event. But, I mean, I would say right now we're probably minus 120 emails, because it's a Monday, maybe more, that have come in over the weekend and that were not completed on Friday. And then the phones are not being answered right now because the phone representative is on this call. So anybody who doesn't leave a voicemail, and many of them will call back 3 and 4 times, yes, only one person can get in at a time.
Right.
I can tell you this, that in the last couple of weeks, the average number of calls is between 40 and 60 or more, depending on the day of the week, of which maybe half get answered, and they all get responded to eventually, but many of them get an email response if they leave contact information.
Sure.
So your specific question, I would say it may take 3 days to get a call back if you are not lucky enough to get through to the answering party.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Is this an appropriate time to clarify about the two-year renewal?
That's actually a separate agenda item.
It is a separate agenda. Yeah, sorry. I remember seeing it on there, and I just thought it was...
Well, that's going to be a great opportunity this morning for you guys to weigh in, and we have our consultant present on the call this morning, and I don't want to do spoiler alert, so we won't go into too much of that, but... you'll probably have some robust discussion this morning on that whole issue, and based on her presentation, you probably noticed this morning an updated email with a new draft for your consideration that was completed by Jessica Ross on Friday. So that's specifically on the agenda after the speaker this morning.
I'm sorry to take so much time here, but when it comes, you made a really good point once, when it comes to license applications, first-time applications, that the most important thing to do is to fill out the application before you start submitting materials, because the application creates a file.
Right.
Right? Sure. Don't get the cart in front of the horse, so to speak. What happens if I don't fill out an application and I send you a transcript or a thing? What happens to that stuff? Does it just get tossed because it doesn't line up with anything? Or?
Madam Chair, Board Member Tapscott, if you promise to keep this a secret, nothing is thrown away. Everything is retained. But it's kind of an electronic version of the scene from Indiana Jones where the warehouse is full of boxes. Because we oftentimes get pieces in advance, and we have no application. We sometimes even have no payment. People mean well. They'll send us a fingerprint card. Sometimes the fingerprint card is not completed. I wish we had a virtual assistant. Maybe Centia will come up with something like that. But we do retain everything. Nothing is lost. It's all an electronic file. Everything is scanned and then retained. So then when they comply with the application and the fee payment and they're officially in the process, those items are manually added to the file. So, but don't share them with anybody.
Thank you.
Director Ogerton, I also wanted to clarify, too, when somebody has filled out their application and submitted all of the documentation necessary or not, are they still getting a deficiency notice via email if something is missing from their application file?
Yes, Madam Chair. The way it works is anybody who puts in an initial application, even if you've done everything correct and everything is submitted, you'll still get, I would call it an inventory letter, but they've been calling it a deficiency letter since Abraham Lincoln. So we'll call it a deficiency letter, but it's really nothing more than an itemized list of things that are missing in order for your application to be complete. But again, and I know this sounds counterintuitive, but you've got 90 days you're waiting anyway, so it's important to get things in. Another little secret is if you want to really be fast on this process, get your application and your fee payment in and the inked fingerprint, because that starts the 90-day clock. And a lot of people do everything else, and the fingerprint comes in a month or two afterwards, and then they are waiting 4 and 5 months. So really, if you can get your application in and digital payment at the DOA payment portal, and then your fingerprint card in, it goes directly to the investigator, who sends it to DPS, and he can only send up to 30 at a time. I mean, picture bureaucracy, and then picture more bureaucracy. That's kind of the way this whole process works. So just because you sent your card in today, we still can't transmit it unless we have a sufficient number to DPS. And then from DPS, they go to DC for review, and that's kind of the whole process. But that would be my suggestion, is application, payment, and the fingerprint card. And then as long as I've got you for 10 more seconds, don't forget there's two fingerprint cards, one to us and the other to DPS. And a lot of people are catching on to this, and they have their level one card back before they get their FBI report back, which is an optimum situation. So.
And so on that, too, I want to mention how important it is for applicants to check their emails regularly and make sure that the board email is not ending up in the spam box or the junk mail, because there might be something deficient from their application, and that would save them a whole lot of time from calling and emailing the board when they may have already had the information. All right. Next on our agenda, item number 8. We have a wonderful presenter today, Ms. Mai Lynn Petrin, Director of Legal and Regulatory Affairs from FSMTB. And Mai, you're going to be doing a presentation today on the unfortunate intersection between human trafficking and illicit enterprises posing as massage businesses. I just want to thank you for being here and sharing this information with us. Thank you for joining us. This is a very important topic, and the virtual floor is yours.
Tom, can I share my screen?
Madam Chair, Mylene, yes, and I have a colleague who's going to assist you, but try it yourself first. You should already have access.
says I'm not allowed to share my screen.
Okay.
So if someone wants to share my presentation, I'll just...
No, we definitely want to get it up there. Hold on just one second here.
Please try it again.
Oh, here we go. Can everybody see?
Yes.
Yes.
As Chair Ryder indicated, my name is Mylynn Petrine, and I am the Director of Legal and Regulatory Affairs at the FSMTB. I'm kind of giving you an encore presentation of my session at the Arizona State Bar Convention last week. That was the annual meeting of all attorneys that are licensed in the state of Arizona. There was a three-hour session one morning with respect to human trafficking and child labor trafficking in front of a number of attorneys. There were not as many assistant attorney generals present as I would have liked, but there were some immigration attorneys and private attorneys that represent victims of human trafficking and sex trafficking. I do want to have a disclaimer here. These are my opinions and my comments, and this is for educational purposes only. And these opinions and views do not represent those of the Federation of State Massage Therapy Boards or the Arizona State Massage Therapy Board. I hope that at the end of this session, these are kind of the learning objectives, that you'll have an understanding of the relationship that massage therapy regulation has regarding human trafficking. You'll be able to explain how illicit massage businesses attempt to legitimize their model. You can identify some applicable laws and regulations in the administrative and regulatory arenas and the limitations and gaps therein that are exploited by these organized crime cartels. And we'll have a little bit of information on how fraud is manifesting itself in the massage therapy licensure process and how to detect it. And most importantly, a better understanding of the need for collaboration between regulatory authorities, law enforcement, investigators, prosecutors, and victims assistance organizations. Just a little bit about FSMTB. We are a not-for-profit association of the state massage regulatory boards and agencies. Our mission is to support our member boards, and Arizona State Massage Board of Massage Therapy is a member. We support them to ensure that their work in the practice of massage therapy is provided to the public safely and competently. One of the primary services that we offer to the massage regulatory boards is the massage and bodywork licensing examination, also known as the MBLEX. It's the only national exam for licensure in massage therapy and currently used by 47 jurisdictions. One of the things, services we also do is collaboration with the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, and other state and local law enforcement agencies. I'm going to diverge here and just talk a little bit about just basic statistics about human trafficking. This information is from the 2021, the Human Trafficking Hotline. You can see that total trafficking situations are over 10,000, involving more than 16,500 likely victims. The top five types of trafficking are listed here, and they all relate to sex trafficking, sex trafficking. This data is from the Polaris Project, who runs the National Human Trafficking Hotline. With respect to Arizona, the 2021 data, there were 651 calls, 240 were from survivors. And I just want to note that this data is only calls to the hotline, so it likely significantly underestimates the extent of the problem. With respect to the 2021 Arizona data, you can see the types of venues for the trafficking cases. Illicit massage and spa is just following the pornography, and hotel motel based. And I would also note that Some of the illicit massage businesses are starting out calls, which would then kind of duplicate the hotel-motel-based data. Going back to the national data, the 16, almost 17,000 cases, you can see the breakdown of the sex and illicit massage. It's the green and the white, which is the majority of human trafficking cases. One of the publications that the Polaris Project released back in 2019, I believe, is their Typology of Modern Slavery. And they define illicit massage as, their definition is, illicit massage, health and beauty businesses present a facade of legitimate spa services, concealing that their primary business is sex and labor trafficking of women. Although they appear to be single storefronts, the majority are controlled as part of larger networks, with one to three people owning several businesses at a time. So it's not just one storefront that we're dealing with. It's a part of a larger network locally and as well as nationally and internationally. And I did some brief research on Arizona, and you can see that Phoenix is a hotbed, nearly 350 arrests with respect to human trafficking and sex crimes. And then the Department of Justice, a former San Diego police officer, and others pled guilty to crimes stemming from illicit massage businesses. And this was in Tempe, Arizona, and California. This was dating back to 2013, and a former cop. This is a pictorial that was provided by Polaris at the FSMTV annual meeting last year. And you can see the heat map of where illicit massage businesses are located. And California is one entry point, Alhambra, and then Flushing, New York on the East Coast. And you can see how they flow eastward and then south. There was a great article from Forbes about the $4.5 billion erotic massage parlor economy. And one of the quotes from that article, and I put a link here, and my presentation can be made available to anyone who would like to see it with respect to the links. Illicit massage businesses often use euphemistic terms like body work and body rubs to get around licensing laws, and these are found in every state, from remote strip malls to bustling cities. I put this quote in here because I wanted to identify scope of practice exemptions as a problem for massage therapy regulation and particularly enforcement. These exemptions make enforcement of unlicensed practice very difficult. Examples might include body work, reflexology, craniosacral therapy, naturopathy. You know, all of the kind of sub practices are problematic. With respect to the number of illicit massage businesses, Polaris estimates there are about 9,000, whereas the network estimates there are about 11,000. But this is probably too low by at least half. If you go to RubMax, a review site for, quote, happy ending massage parlors, they list more than 25,000 businesses in the United States. FSMTD has undertaken an effort to identify and cause awareness to its member boards about the intersection of illicit massage and human trafficking with regulation. We had a human trafficking task force report released in 2017, and it can be found on our website. But one of the some of the key findings in this report are human trafficking is prevalent within the massage profession, unfortunately. The most concerning impact of trafficking on the profession is that it endangers therapists and the public. So as Chair Ryder said earlier, LMTs are part of the public. Another finding is that trafficking costs, both monetary and otherwise, are significant for professionals and consumers. Human trafficking is linked with fraud in the massage therapy education and in the licensing pathways. Innovative law enforcement interventions and municipal code changes that focus on IMBs, illicit massage businesses, and their operatives are emerging. You can see, just generally speaking across the country, the proliferation of human trafficking or anti-human trafficking commissions and task forces that is becoming more law enforcement and regulators becoming more aware of it. So some of the challenges with respect to the arena of massage therapy regulation that kind of enable human trafficking and illicit massage to persist are the lack of uniformity and licensing requirements. The massage therapy education requirement across the country can vary anywhere between 500 to 1,200 hours. And then there is an emerging online and distance education trend, and not every massage therapy board in the country has recognized this. They're lagging behind and don't realize that some of these massage education programs are fully online, and you get a massage transcript or massage education transcript, you can't tell. There's no uniformity in what percentage or what coursework is allowed to happen online and what should be in person. There's variability in criminal background check requirements. Some states have none. Some states only have a state. Some require an FBI or both, and whether or not the state uses the RAP Act. Also, there's variability in the licensing examination. Most jurisdictions utilize the MBLEX. Some have a state examination. But if someone's coming from Arizona from another state that only has state examination, you may not realize that they haven't taken a national examination. And then some states don't have any examination, such as California. There's a variability in whether massage therapy is considered a healthcare profession or an occupation. Going back to massage education, there's real lack of consensus on a national accrediting body. Most massage therapy schools are privately owned, small businesses. They're not community colleges. They're not, they don't exist in, public universities. Accreditation may not be required because, federal student loan money isn't at issue. And then there's also variability across the country in whether massage establishments are regulated. So all of these gaps and these differences create opportunities for bad actors. And I want to also call attention to, it's not just in massage therapy. So recently there was Operation Nightingale in January of this year, where the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General identified three fake nursing schools. So it's, massage therapy isn't alone. I guess we can take some solace in that. There were 25 individuals involved in these fake schools, 7,600 fraudulent diplomas, and over 2,000 nurses are involved. One of the things FSMTV also does is try to protect its intellectual property in the MBLEX. We file copyright infringement actions against individuals and entities who harvest test questions, and then translate them into other languages to provide, quote, training to these students where they memorize the keyword in the question and then the keyword in the answer. So this is a huge problem. It creates issues for, yes, they might have passed the examination, but they didn't do it on their own attributes and credentials. One of the challenges, too, is that while FSMTV sees a lot of the fraud and the diploma mills that come through the process of applying to take the MBLEX, we have absolutely no authority over massage therapy school or program approval and recognition. We rely on the state licensing boards and the states to identify an approved or recognized school, which is a problem, and I'll talk about that next. Drilling down to Arizona, according to you guys, I believe you have about 11,000 active licensees. And again, you've talked about this earlier, 4 staff members, and you have had a vacancy for over 2 years. You also do not have currently state-based massage establishment oversight. Now, there might be municipalities and cities that have local requirements, and the variability in their requirements and their inspection and enforcement authority is also problematic for enforcement of illicit massage. And the board is undergoing its sunset review and audit. Arizona was one of the first states to pass universal license recognition, and it's trending to happen in many other states to improve portability of professional and occupational licenses. The problem that Arizona may have is that you are directly next to California, and California has voluntary certification. There's not licensure in California. But I'm not sure that all of the certificates in California understand the difference. And they come through Arizona, and then you can have to give them an Arizona license, which they can then take and go to other states. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because you guys are intimately familiar with it. 18 years of age, be a citizen or legal resident, have a high school diploma. One of the primary issues that you've been dealing with recently is the criminal history and the changes to the bars and the things that prevent someone from being licensed. You have a 500-hour education requirement, and the licensing examination is only required for those coming from out-of-state schools. Again, this is a gap that is exploited by bad actors. So one of the issues with Arizona in the education is that if you look at your statute, you have to do one of the following: either complete a massage therapy education at a board-recognized school that's nationally accredited. And as I mentioned earlier, the majority of massage therapy education schools and programs are not nationally accredited. One of the few national accreditors is CAMHSA, the Commission on Massage Therapy Education. And right now, I think nationally, they have less than 20 schools that they accredit across the country. Or if you don't complete a massage therapy education there, you can complete one at a school licensed by the state BPPE, or if you go to school outside Arizona, you have to take the licensing exam. So one of the gaps is that if you attend a school inside Arizona or one that's accredited, you don't have to take the licensing examination. One of the mischaracterizations is that the licensing examination is an assessment of entry-level competence and safety to practice. It's not a capstone to the education process. It's based on a job task analysis, not curriculum. So the fact that you went to massage therapy education is a separate criteria and requirement from demonstrating your entry-level competence by passing a national psychometrically validated licensing examination. I'm going to repeat myself here, but the MBLEX is only required currently for those applicants coming from out of state. And it's my understanding it is a board priority to implement the MBLEX for all Arizona applicants. And that would bring you kind of in line, you know, across the country and in line with those other jurisdictions that require the MBLEX. The gaps in massage education. So I mentioned it a little bit earlier. Many state boards of massage therapy have authority to approve curriculum and authorize massage schools to operate. However, in many states, the massage board does not have that authority. They have authority only over the curriculum, how many hours and what categories those hours should be taught in. And they delegate or they defer to the state education authorizer to approve or recognize massage therapy schools and programs. This can be a problem in many states because those departments of education are large, bureaucratic, and do not have the subject matter expertise in what a massage therapy education is and should be. Many times the licensing process with the state education authorizer is filling out an application, paying your fee, indicating you have a physical presence, that you have a student refund policy, and that you have your syllabus or your curriculum outline. They do not look at, you know, anything else, whether the quality of the education is good. They may not realize that the education is fully online, and many states' massage boards won't take a fully online massage education. So these gaps between the state education authorizer and the massage board create vulnerabilities in the approval and recognition process of massage therapy schools, which are exploited. And you create diploma mills, and then these bad actors will go to the most permissive states, get a license, and then move to another state. Fraud manifests itself in the education process as well as the MBLEX and taking the MBLEX. We have diploma mills, which are basically not schools at all, but transcript creators. We do have fraudulent schools, which claim to be schools but are really training programs for the MBLEX. We have test prep programs. There's item harvesting that we try. That one of the reasons that FSMPD uses the Pearson Professional Centers is it because it has the highest level of security to avoid proxy testing. We do a lot of data analysis in the background to identify potential harvesters and individuals that come in to test, purposely fail, and try to memorize, you know, 10 to 20 questions. We have no authority over the massage education schools. But even when a massage board revokes an approval or recognition of a school, it can still continue to operate based on the education authorizer not taking action. I can tell you a number of stories where the massage board and FSMTB have provided information to the state education authorizer about fraud, fake schools, fake diplomas, and nothing happens. One of the things we try to do is, again, educate those education authorizers about fraud and the prevalence in massage therapy education. Our executive director co-authored a toolkit with the Colorado Department of Regulatory Affairs. It can be found on our website to give you some tools and red flags about fraud and education in higher education. And we also co-authored an article with the network, which is a great resource in combating illicit massage, that talks about these gaps in education oversight and differences that vary from state to state. These toolkits and these articles were prompted in some part by an effort in out of Colorado, where there were two individuals convicted, federally convicted, of fraud in providing fake transcripts to licensees, selling them, and then those transcripts being submitted to Colorado Department of Regulation for Massage Therapy licenses. They were actually sentenced to prison time, but it took a collaborative effort to identify and convict these entities involved the FBI, Kansas City and Oklahoma divisions, and local police departments in Colorado, the Denver Police, and the Colorado Department of Regulatory Affairs. So, I mean, it takes a lot of work. It takes time, but we do try to be vigilant and stop, you know, shut down these fake schools when we can. One of the things that FSMTB is able to provide to law enforcement and prosecutors is, you know, information that we obtain demographic and otherwise through the MBLEX application process. You can see, we see a lot of transcripts that come through this office, and you can see variances. One of the ways that fraud is identified is that the school that someone applies for when they take the MBLEX is different from the massage school they list on their licensing application. So a lot of times we're alerted to fraud by the state massage board when they say, oh, well, this person says they went to X school, but when they took the exam a month ago, they said they went to Y school. So that's one way that we identify it or that you identify it. We also have the massage therapy licensing database that's available to member boards, and the application data from FSMTB is uploaded into that, as well as license and disciplinary data from participating state boards. So that's another resource you can use to identify, has someone lost the license in another state and now they're coming to Arizona to get relicensed. You know, because they're always honest on the application about whether they've had a license revoked in the past. One of the gaps for Arizona specifically is the lack of massage establishment regulation. About 20 states currently have some type of massage establishment oversight. It can vary from it's just a registry, it's a facility permit, or it's an actual license. The types of regulatory frameworks for massage establishments vary. Some of it is just health and hygiene enforcement, and then some have a specific anti-human trafficking, anti-prostitution stance. There are some states that don't do this, and they have local oversight, and it becomes a whack-a-mole approach. You shut an establishment down in one city, and they just move to another city next door. Some states say that they believe their Department of Health regularly inspects these facilities, but many times a Department of Health does not have unannounced inspection authority, and that's where you can typically and most easily identify signs of human trafficking if it's unannounced. In addition, there's a lack of training and education by law enforcement and code enforcement. So when they go and do their fire inspections, they may not be trained to identify evidence of human trafficking when entering these facilities. So, as I said, no massage establishment regulation in Arizona. But the FSMTB has convened a massage establishment regulation task force, and it is developing model statutory language as well as an inspection toolkit. So this is an effort in support of our mission to promote uniformity of massage establishment regulation across the country. What can be done? And remember that I did this presentation in front of some attorneys hoping that they would give some support to the Arizona State Board of Massage Therapy. But one of the things would be to undertake a comprehensive review of your laws and your regulations to identify these gaps. You're aware you have a regulatory resources issue with respect to funding and staffing of the board. Perhaps you could implement state-based massage establishment licensing and regulation. And if permitted, one of the things that you could do is share information when there's parallel criminal and administrative proceedings. And every state varies, and I didn't investigate or research the actual regulations with respect to what criminal information might be available to the board and vice versa. But understand what data you have as the board as well as FSMTB, and make sure that you're, you know, sharing with who you can. What else can be done? I referenced this a little earlier, training for law enforcement, local and state code enforcers. As I said, health department inspectors, building code, fire inspectors, as well as your own investigators and inspectors, they need to understand the signs of human trafficking and illicit massage. I mean, when you get a massage license, it's legitimizing, one, the lack of photographs that Chair Ryder mentioned earlier. You know, law enforcement can go in and they see the licenses of individuals with names only, but they can't necessarily match those with the therapists or the employees on site. Cultural competence education. The network, and I put their website there, is a great resource about better understanding of the cultural norms and values that are exploited by the traffickers with respect to this population of generally women, but not only, with respect to being victimized. One of the other gaps is we need to evaluate the unintended consequences of second chance and collateral consequences laws. So these are all in efforts, you know, criminal justice reform, rehabilitating, showing evidence of rehabilitation. But one of the questions, maybe it's more of a philosophical musing of mine, is do these second chance laws actually exacerbate human trafficking and illicit massage? So if you're not allowed to deny a license based on a prostitution conviction or disturbing the peace, if sometimes they're pled down, and you are unable to take someone's license because of it, is that facilitating the trafficker from continuing to victimize and exploit these women? I'm not sure what the solution is. And one of the insights that I gained from this presentation and the discussions with the immigration attorneys is that they are, you know, pressured by the immigration attorney for these women to plead down the conviction or the arrest because they don't want them to get deported. So they're, you know, the empathy of we don't want to send these women out of the country maybe is actually having the unintended consequence of continuing them to be victimized. And one of the other things that the board can do is try to reduce turf wars and jurisdictional conflicts. You know, if there's local law enforcement, federal law enforcement, they need to work together because this is it's organized crime, it's a cartel, and we need to work together and in parallel rather than against each other. I tried to come up with a graphic that kind of displayed visually the mess of anti-human trafficking efforts. There are so many different parts and agencies and different entities trying to effect change and mitigate human trafficking, but they don't work together right now at all. We're gaining awareness of the need to collaborate, but it's still kind of, it's really kind of a mess. So collaboration is the key. And if we can work together, share information, understand what information the different agencies have, I think we can maybe make the diagram look more like this. And I couldn't figure out how to make little arrows both in both directions, but it goes both ways. It's not, you know, necessarily circular. But I want us to be more organized and intentional about how we attack this issue. But it does take trust, and sharing information and supporting each other, and supporting other agencies. It has to be intentional. And that's all I have. Happy to answer some questions. Again, I'm just repeating the objectives. But there's my contact information, and thank you for letting me talk to you today.
My, thank you so much. That was incredible. I do have some comments and some questions. One, this has always been, those who know me, it's a little bit of a hot button, so I want to say this as respectfully as possible. Because the term illicit massage business has been used so often, I would love to see one small step to untangle this unfortunate intersection, and that would be to change the language slightly to calling these enterprises what they really are, that they are enterprises posing as massage businesses. Because I think that untangling the term illicit massage business, I think from the public standpoint, it creates a bit of separation of what massage is and what these enterprises really are, which is not massage.
Right.
So that would be my first comment. But I know that the term has been used for quite some time, so that it may not be as easy to change. But I will always continue to voice my opinion on that. Mm-hmm. I do want to mention, you had mentioned in your presentation universal licensing. And on that, too, I understand that there's been some talk about interstate compact and states that are wanting to get involved. And I know one of the challenges for Arizona is that we may not be eligible for interstate compact because of our universal licensing. And I'm wondering if you have any knowledge or insight as to, you know, how would a state go about, you know, if we were to if we wanted to adopt Interstate Compact to increase portability for massage therapists, is there a way to, I guess, get out of the universal licensing portion of it if the Interstate Compact is adopted?
It's not true that just because you have a universal license recognition law that you are not eligible for the compact. Any state that licenses massage therapy is eligible for the compact. So California currently is not eligible right now because they don't license. They only voluntarily certify. And there are other states that have just a registry, and then there are states that don't regulate massage therapy at all right now. So when you pass the compact, it actually becomes, it relegates universal licensing. So it takes primacy over the universal licensing law. There's specific language in there about that, that any law that would conflict with the compact, compact prevails.
So Interstate Compact would supersede universal law if it was adopted by Arizona?
Correct.
Take note. Very good. My other question would be, and I might have to defer to our investigator on this because he attended one of the conferences, and there was a question about Pearson vetting schools and their qualifications to take MBLACs. I just want to clarify, so in order for an individual to be qualified to take MBLACs, they have to have gone through a program that has already been vetted by Pearson. Is that accurate? Or
Pearson does not vet education.
Okay.
When an individual applies to FSMCB to take the MBLEX, their massage education must comply with the massage education policy. And right now we defer to the state board, and with respect to whether the education is approved or recognized. For those state boards that don't have that authority, we then look to the state education authorizer. So it's a mishmash.
It is. And then finally, this year the legislation had passed the requirement for massage therapists in the state of Arizona to obtain a level 1 non-IVP clearance card. And I believe that some of this, having this card, will maybe help with some of the local municipalities and some of their requirements. I think that working with AMTA and ABMP, so there are some individuals that work with local municipalities to update their ordinances. It's because there are quite a few cities like Scottsdale, Chandler, many other cities that require massage therapists to get fingerprinted every year or every other year to conduct business in their city. And I believe that having that level 1 clearance card, if they have that, it might be pointless to have that requirement. So I guess my question with that would be, do you work does FSMTV work with other organizations such as AMTA, ABMP, and government relations to help with local municipalities and their requirements as well?
We do work with AMTA and ABMP, and whenever a local or city or municipality or other jurisdiction seeks our input, we try to provide that as best we can with model language, examples of other ordinances that are kind of considered best practices. But yes, we do collaborate frequently with ABMP and AMTA with respect to government relations.
And I think at the end of the day, it's just getting the local municipalities to actually take off and do something about it rather than just sit back and listen.
Yeah, and that's an education. You know, it's just kind of a public relations effort that the board could undertake if it had more resources and staff, just to, you know, send a notice that we require this now, so maybe you don't need to. And, you know, the therapists, the LMTs in Arizona could also say to the municipalities, hey, I've already gotten a more strict and stringent and passed a criminal background or history check. So is this really necessary and duplicative? Because, you know, you don't want to charge an LMT twice for kind of slightly different things when one is kind of the umbrella and the other background checks are kind of sub to that.
Agreed, agreed. I have no other questions. I dominated most of it anyway. So I would like to pass it off to our other board members. Board Member Tapscott, let's start with you.
Thank you, Chair Ryder. Thank you, Chair Ryder, for your trying to uncouple, illicit massage business really from the fact that it's an illicit business with a massage sign in the window, which is a little bit different in my mind. Wow. To that point, Ms. Petrine, I don't even know if you know the answer to these questions, but just to try to get more clarification, do we know what percentage of individuals arrested nationwide and, for sex trafficking-related crimes hold a legitimate massage license? Do we know what percentage have taken the MLEX and somehow worked their way around that? Do we know those type of numbers?
I don't know those type of numbers, and I don't know how you would even obtain that. One of the interesting things at this association meeting of all these lawyers is it was news to them that massage therapy is regulated in Arizona. That, to me, came as a shock. If the attorneys in the state of Arizona don't even realize that massage therapy is regulated, when they become an assistant AG or a prosecutor and they're arresting somebody, they wouldn't even think to look to see whether they have a massage license, whether it's, from the state, whether it's from the local municipality, whether it's just, we know that law enforcement has seen therapists or sex workers, victims, pull out their MLEX results thinking that that's their license. So, it's, a whole bunch of education that needs to be undertaken within the state of Arizona and their, the administrative side and the prosecutorial, the criminal enforcement side.
Wow. That's frightening. I guess my concern about some of this stuff, too, is that it sounds like there's this constant flow of trying to stop individuals from, coming through by tightening up licensing requirements and all that stuff, which makes a lot of sense to me, but also seems to put a lot of, seems to be going after the victim a little bit, too, and I worry about the flow continuing. And you mentioned the Polaris Project. One of the things they cite is one of the biggest problems is really that we're unable to go after the business owners because of corporate privacy laws. And so that when somebody can open up a business establishment, and they really can hide their identity, they can open up several, and when we shut those down, they open up several more, and the victims get prosecuted, but the owners just move on to a new establishment because they can kind of hide behind shell companies and such because of corporate privacy laws. And it just seemed to be a major finding of their report, the Polaris report that you mentioned, that would be a real logical thing to go after since we'd be going after the people that are feeding the system.
I would agree with you, Board Member Tapscott, with respect to going after the business owners. Right now, there's not a lot of laws in the books that allow the law enforcement to do that. I don't think that the issue is really corporate privacy. It's more about even if when you get a business license at the local level, you can put down your name, someone else's name. It doesn't ask you, has that person had a criminal background check? Some states are now, when they are enacting massage establishment regulation, requiring the owner, if they're not an LMT, to take the state jurisprudence, a course on the laws and rules of massage therapy regulation. Some states have gotten creative in asking for more information on the owners, the corporate entity, background check, and then prohibiting if they get shut down. At the state level, because, you can do this at the state level, not allowing that entity, that person, owner, corporation to open another business within two or 3 or 5 years.
One last question. Sorry. And this might be out of your scope too. But you mentioned like some people be encouraged to actually plea down a charge, by an immigration lawyer or something, which I'm sure goes on. Do we know the percentage of victims that are immigrants compared to native-born in the nation? Does that make sense? There are sex trafficking victims that are, yeah.
I don't know that number off the top of my head, but my understanding from interactions and going to presentations for Polaris and the network is that it's a significant number. Almost all are not born in the United States.
Oh. Okay. Thank you.
Can you clarify that then, for working in massage?
The victims of human trafficking and sex trafficking are primarily not born in the United States. They're immigrants. There was a lot of talk in the other part of my session from an immigration attorney, and there are now specific visas allowed for, permitted for human trafficking victims. There's 5,000 a year nationally, and only 1,000 get used. So I think it was also an education to those immigration attorneys that there's other avenues for visas that, because, there's a limit on the other kind, and then they're being, that maximum is being hit every year, so this might be another pathway. But proving human trafficking and proving that you're a victim of human trafficking is very hard because these women don't want to testify. They don't want to admit that they're a victim of human trafficking. They may not even realize that they are.
Can I just add one point? I was just pulling up the Polaris report. It looks like from their report that half are immigrants, which would mean half are native-born legal residents, which is significant. I want to point out it may not be more. It sounds like it's 50-50, 48-52. So it sounds like we have a problem with people born here being victimized as much as people coming here being victimized, and it's very equal.
Yeah, with the illicit massage, it might be a different proportion versus just human trafficking in general.
That was just human trafficking in general, yeah.
Vice Chair Moon, do you have any questions or comments for Mai?
Yeah, and I will try to be brief, and thank you so much. Mostly just to piggyback off of some of your statements during your presentation, but I cannot score enough how grossly underreported this issue is. The numbers that we saw Polaris is capturing is not even getting us the real number. And like you just mentioned, I don't think a lot of lay community members understand that majority of human trafficking survivors do not have the understanding or the label that they are being victimized. The grooming that is part of human trafficking is robust, and they are landing in what is assumed to be holistic, real relationships. And so it is a layering process to really get someone to self-identify as being a trafficking victim and then getting out of life. My other two things, and this is more so for the board and or Arizona, House Bill 2862 allocated millions, I want to say $10 or $8 million, through DEMA, which is Department of Emergency and Military Affairs, to combat, respond to human trafficking as well as providing training. Those dollars have to be administered implanted through law enforcement, which is really exciting for us in the response world, because now we have law enforcement agencies, jurisdictions throughout the states that are allocating and receiving this grant to start training on human trafficking. So this is a really great moment, especially, and it is through the Arizona Human Trafficking Council that is really pushing for all law enforcement jurisdictions to apply. We are partnering New Life Center with the county attorney's office, so I will be talking to the county attorney about how can we assure that prosecutors know about this issue. And then lastly, for the board as well, I'm wondering if, not to give staff more work, but our investigator, I'm wondering if, there is any interest in him sitting in some of our SART groups, so sexual assault response teams. We have one in Phoenix. New Life Center administers one in the West Valley, but to your point, Mia, it really, a sexual assault response team is a collaborative approach because one hand does not know what the other hand is doing. So that could position the massage board in being in meetings where all jurisdictions, all different disciplines are working together in a meeting and hopefully cross-sharing information to help survivors. That's it. Thank you.
One of the efforts is I think that massage board investigators and the prosecutorial side and their investigators need to be cognizant of is trauma-informed investigations and not re-victimizing the person, the arrestee, due to, I mean, they're going through trauma and understanding how that trauma affects their recollection as part of the investigatory and the hearing process, I think is really important. And a bad memory doesn't mean that it didn't happen.
Very good, very good. Wow, this is an incredible presentation. And Vice Chair Moon, thank you also for sharing your nuggets of information there as well. This is incredible. I hope that everybody on our virtual conference today got a lot of information out of that. I would love to get access or a copy of your presentation. So that we can review it at our leisure as well, if that's possible.
Tom has it.
Perfect, perfect. Thank you so much for joining us. You're welcome to stay longer if you like. If you've got other things to do, then please. We just want to thank you for joining us today and educating us.
Well, thank you for letting me join you. And for all the work that you do. I know you're volunteers and you don't get thanked enough. You know, it's hard being a massage board member, especially in light of your board's situation with the state. So thank you.
Thank you. All right. We're going to move along to item number 9 in the agenda. Proposed board policy language specifying state massage duration. Okay, so this is something that I would love to cover a little bit. So compliance with the Arizona Auditor General Office finding contained in the board's sunset performance audit requires a specific state massage board policy specifying that the license shall be issued for a period of not more than 24 months. And the board's practice used since 2003, the licensing applicants by the birth date, issuance date, and to call upon Jessica Ross, who is a board consultant on regulatory and legislative drafting and formal legal counsel to the Governor's Regulatory Review Council. Jessica, can you explain your findings regarding the Arizona rules and statutes that are contradictory to the Auditor General's findings?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This is Jessica Thomas, and I have been brought on as a consultant for the massage board to help with the policies and procedures, as well as their rules and really any other administrative items in the regulatory nature. I will preface what I have to say with the fact that while I am an attorney, I do not represent the board and I cannot provide the board any legal advice. So I would rephrase, I guess, my analysis, not necessarily as findings so much as commentary on how I am seeing the board's policies and rules jive, for lack of a better word, with their current statutes. So with that, if you don't mind me sharing, I can pull up the draft policy that you guys are contemplating for renewal of licenses.
Yes, thank you.
Uh-huh. And that might give us a good starting point. Give me one second.
And we can see your screen.
Perfect. Okay, so I briefly looked over the audit that was shared with me in anticipation of drafting a policy that meets those requirements. What I saw in the audit was something essentially saying that the board needed a policy that clarified that the licenses that the board issues are not issued for any longer period of time than 2 years. When you compare that recommendation for that type of policy with the statutory framework that's currently in place, that's where you get this second paragraph here, 32-4225A. A license issued pursuant to this chapter is subject to renewal every other year on the licensee's birthday and expires unless renewed. There is nothing that I saw in the statute, which, again, is not a comprehensive review of your statutes, but I did not see anything that indicated that a license was only good or could only be good for 2 years from the date of issue. In fact, this language suggests that quite the opposite. The date of issue has nothing to do with when a license renews. In fact, it simply renews on the licensee's birthday every other year after the license has been issued. So in that situation, you may end up with licensees, depending on when they have submitted their application and when their application is approved and they are issued their license, you may have people who have a license that is issued comparatively to their birth date that actually gives them a license for less than 2 years or more than 2 years. Now, that's for an initial license because there, every 2 years thereafter, it'll continue to renew on their birthday. But that initial license that is issued, based on this statutory framework, could, in theory, be longer than 2 years or even less than 2 years. And then I'd be happy to discuss any of the other language that's listed on this policy, but I think that's a good starting point for board discussion. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Jessica. I think that one of the things that I'd like to bring up is that since the board's inception, we've always used the license holder's birth date as the expiration date for their license. And we've been kind of going back and forth now saying that it's not the birth date that it expires because of what we were told with the auditors. I personally would be in favor of continuing it to be the license holder's birth date. That's what most people are familiar with. That's what they know. It's easy to remember. And granted, yes, there are going to be some that might have a initial application that's shorter than 2 years, and some will have more. But that's the way the cookie crumbles. It's easy to remember your birth date as your expiration date or renewal date. That's my opinion on it, and I would love to hear from the other board members on the topic.
This is Board Member Tapscott. I 100% agree with you. That was my interpretation of the statute all along, really. And while we might even argue the initial issuing of the license and say it should never go over 2 years, having it on the birthday makes perfect sense to me, even if you end up getting a license for a year and a half for your first application. But my other question goes to renewals, because it seemed like for a brief period of time we were renewing 2 years from the date of renewal, not 2 years from the date the license ended. Does that make sense? So, and I don't read that practice in anywhere. I don't understand why we can't always renew licenses for 2 years from the date, not that they're applied to renew, but the date that they would end, that license would end. We're only extending the license another 2 years. That seems to always fall within the statutes.
Right. So, I think that, you know, that would probably be a question for board staff, but I think that ultimately, and I know that we've done a little bit of back and forth now because we were scolded because of our previous practices. So I guess my question would be, are we changing it all? Would we be changing it all back to the birth dates for everyone, including those who got a different renewal date? You know, it's of course it would be a little bit confusing for people, but in the long run, it might be better.
That would be my preference, but that's easy for me to say because I don't have to administer it.
Agreed.
But yes, I thought the old system was actually a very good one.
Director Overton, do you have anything that you would like to add to that, answering our questions?
Madam Chair and Board Member Tapscott, what you described, again, I'm not an attorney, but I believe is the intent. So, for example, suppose someone does not renew within the 60 days prior to expiration, and in fact they take another 6 months before they renew. One of the biggest misnomers for licensees is that they think the 2 years starts when they put the renewal in, but the clock never stops. Whether or not you renew or not renew, it's almost like the life expectancy that when your expiration date came up, whether or not you renewed, that date is immutable. And that's why a lot of people who apply late are actually then renewing less than a year or sometimes a year and a quarter right after that because the clock never stops. So, and in fact, I mean, as you all know, the board was created in 2003, and when the automation, what we have, was instituted in 2010, it was coded to, in fact, use the birth date as the expiration, meaning that most people would remember who are practicing in the industry that, oh, I better get my license renewed because my birthday's coming up. It's just a very powerful, effective reminder for people as to when their license could go inactive. And when Jessica did this analysis late last week, it was welcomed news because I don't know that we've been keeping up with the different types of suggestions as effectively as we can, but the way the law appears right there in front of you, regardless of whether the board decides to interpret this as greater than 2 years or greater and including less than 2 years, the one thing that would seem to be a certainty is the birth date would always be the end point for a licensee. So, and we had, in fairness, we have not presented this to our Assistant Attorney General on the discussion. This has all happened since last Friday. And the other thing, too, Madam Chair and Board Members, the staff's not looking for a decision today. It's looking for an initial discussion, and maybe between now and the July meeting, there can be some more analysis done, and we can contact the auditors as well. But the board is going to need the policy to go with all the other policies that Jessica's drafting, which will come before you after Labor Day. But this is one that we did want to show in good faith that we're in compliance with the auditors. But today's purpose is for you guys to vet it with Jessica's help as well.
Thank you.
If I can further comment, I agree with that concept. Even if you renew late, it still looks to me, you know, based on this, that your license should renew on your birthday, which is now in less than 2 years, and you've renewed late. That's not our problem. That's just sticking to the statute. My question was, though, for a brief period of time, like when I renewed, my license was renewed on my renewal date. So it wasn't renewed on my birthday, which would be renewing for less than 2 years in my mind. Right? Like, the license was renewed 2 years from the date, but my license was still good for two more months, so it wasn't...
Well, you're correct. Let me tell you the operating theory on that.
Yeah, that's okay.
You know, we don't make up the rules. We're just basically dressed down and we don't do them properly. So here's the argument, Mr. Tapscott. When you initially got your first license, you got in excess of 2 years, so you were being corrected all these years later when you were renewed with the appearance of having lost time, but bringing you back into 24 months maximum, the time that you got on the front end was removed under that interpretation at the back end, even though it was not your birthday.
Right, but when we need to reset it, then by a multiple of 2 years from literally the original date that I applied for a license, I'm not even sure we know what that is, but it wasn't on my birthday. Right.
You know I'm going to defer to Jessica and our Assistant Attorney General are listening, but typically when government has a new interpretation of new law, in my lay opinion, it should be prospective and not retroactive.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that we had a former Assistant AG who advised me, which I thought was very useful, and again, I don't mean to speak for Gene or for Deborah, but and maybe they could respond to a later question, but a license given by a state agency is actually considered a property right. And we need to be very careful of two things that happen in this discussion. The law does require that the board notify anyone 60 days in advance, actually in writing, before their license is expired. And the other is that if we've awarded a license and it is a property right, then do we find ourselves in legal jeopardy by changing that contract agreement from when it was originally issued? Again, not an attorney, probably making anybody from the bar blanch in horror that I'm even having this conversation, but you can see it is a very complex issue, and it was done fine for 20 years up until this audit finding, yeah. And now that we're up to our hips in analysis and self-analysis, I think between this meeting today and coming back and reviewing it again in July, hopefully the board will have a sound policy that matches what the legal advice you get from, so...
So do we think to, and I'm going to use Board Member Tapscott as an example, so that moving forward, his license would then expire on his birthday, regardless of his renewal?
Madam Chair, that's kind of the question that Jessica's here to talk with you today about. And again, I don't want to speak for Jessica, so she can restate that. But in fact, let me just stop there and ask Jessica to respond.
This is Jessica. Again, I can't provide legal advice. All I can do is present you with the connection point between your policies, your rules, and your statutes. In this case, my understanding is that the Auditor General's findings indicated that there was a need for a policy that clarified that licenses are only good for 2 years and would expire after 2 years. I did not find any language in your rules that indicated that a license expires after 2 years after its date of issue. I did not find anything that indicated that when a license is issued, it begins its validity on the licensee's birth date, so that those two would match up. Everything that I have seen and heard has indicated that the board has historically provided licenses within a certain time frame of when they receive the application, if it is approved, and that date of issue is not tied to the member's birthday. In fact, it is on the back end that the renewal and expiration date that is assigned to that license is the same as the licensee's birthday. My understanding is that there has been some change in that recently, and now in developing a policy that clarifies this issue, trying to comply with the Auditor General's report, the question before you now is, how should your licenses be issued, and how should the expiration date be assigned to those licenses so that you are in compliance?
Thank you, Jessica. Vice Chair Moon, do you have any questions or comments on this topic?
I do not. I'm just trying to keep track, but I am in support of everyone else.
Okay. All right, so for clarification, I do want to read, for those who might just be listening and for the audio recording later on if people are choosing to revisit this. So this policy states, staff shall notify a licensee in writing of the expiration date of a licensee's license at least 60 days prior to the expiration date of the license. According to ARS, 32-4225A, a license issued pursuant to this chapter is subject to renewal every other year on the licensee's birthday and expires unless renewed. Upon issuing a license, staff shall assign a license and expiration date that is the licensee's birth date of the second year following the calendar year in which the license was issued. For example, if a license is issued on May 1st, 2023, and the licensee's birth date is January 1st, staff shall assign an expiration date for that license of January 1st, 2025. Similarly, if the license is issued January 1st, 2023, and the licensee's birthday is May 1st, staff shall assign an expiration date for that license of May 1st, 2025. Staff shall not expedite or extend a license expiration date regardless of when the license was issued or when the licensee submits a new renewal application. Staff shall process applications for renewal of a license in the order they are received, regardless of when the license expires. These are the things that we are considering. I don't want to create a motion at this point. I want to give the board members an opportunity to marinate in this, and then hopefully at the next meeting we can revisit this and have a motion once our assistant attorney generals have also vetted the information. Board Member Tapscott?
Thank you. I just want to comment really quickly. We both know how effective the birth date is because we've heard hundreds of people just say, oh, my birthday is coming up. I better make sure I've got to renew. So I love that system. I would think we could fall into compliance by saying that we never renew over 2 years and not extending it 2.5 years depending on when your birthday falls. You either get up to 2 years if you were to apply on your birthday, it would renew 2 years for that. If you were to apply after your birthday, you're going to get a little less than 2 years that first time. And that puts us in compliance. That puts us on birth dates. We're not changing anything really except kind of setting this policy of renewing on birthdays, but we will not issue an initial license for over 2 years. And I would think that would pull us into compliance.
I think that's a very good point. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
I agree. Okay. So, board members, let's marinate in that a little bit. We'll make sure that Ms. DeRoost also has an opportunity to review this as well so that we can get her input at the next meeting. And then hopefully once our assistant attorney generals have had an opportunity to review it as well, we'll have more discussion and maybe even have a motion on it so that we can get everybody back on track with their renewals. At this time, I would like to request a 10-minute comfort break before we move on to item number 10 of the agenda. And we are now returning from our break. It is Monday, June 26th, at 10:56 a.m. We're back in session. Next on our agenda is item number 10. Item for... And we will go right into investigative reviews. And this may include possible cease and desist order and or referral to local law enforcement. So our first case is case 23-044, Jai Feng Wang, MT-26684. This is a preliminary review of the information available to the board at this time. It is not a hearing. Participants of this investigative review, please be sure that your camera is on. Is Jai Feng Wang present at this meeting, and are you represented by counsel?
Yes.
And who is your counsel?
Joy Huang.
Thank you for being here. This
is Joy Huang. Jia Feng Wang is with me right now.
Okay. Do you have camera?
For some reason, my desktop had no camera, but if you want me to go on my cell phone, we could turn on the camera.
We'll go with what we have right now. Investigator David Elson, would you please provide a summary of the complaint against Jai Feng Wang?
On May 19th, the board was notified by MW, who was at the meeting, that while receiving a massage at Golden Feet Reflex, a massage therapist exposed the majority of her backside and did not cover between her legs after separating each leg to work on them separately. She was very uncomfortable. She turned over onto her back. She could barely feel the sheet. It wasn't covering her breast. They then placed the right palm between my breasts and then left under my side breast armpit area pushed down. I did not know or realize what was happening. I absolutely knew this was not something I've experienced during a massage. She said she squirmed a little, and the therapist moved their hand and started to massage the top third of her breast. She said she was very uncomfortable. She said she sat up enough to see her entire right breast was exposed and immediately yanked the sheet up to cover herself. During the course of the investigation, it was discovered the therapist was unlicensed and allowed to perform massage at the owner's place of business, which the owner is the respondent, and that the respondent falsified her initial application for licensure by indicating English was her native language. And MW is here on the call.
Okay. I would like to, if MW would like to make a statement at this time, you may do so.
I think what I included in my initial report sums up pretty much everything. I also included screenshots of my communications with the owner, to which there was a level, well, admitting that this person was not licensed, and leading to the effect of, what can I do to make this right? Please don't go to the police. So I think that's a detail that I'm not sure if you guys have, but is important and disheartening. So I think that's it for now.
Thank you, MW. And the board members did receive copies of the text interactions that you were just talking about. I would like to offer an opportunity for a statement for the counsel of the respondent.
Sure. The worker had called the massage owner before May 17 this year to ask for if he could work at the store, and he needed the money. I will refer in the worker as a Tom. So the worker come, and massage owner, Miss Nguyen, have request massage license and work permit from immigration. Tom said, show the work permit. However, he did not bring the massage license and tell the owner he will bring it back tomorrow. And that day, on May 17, owner specifically request that you could only do foot massage instead of body massage, which he did 3 foot massage that day. The customer lady who make a complaint that she would like a combo, meaning she want to do foot massage and body massage. Therefore, Tom had performed the foot massage. The owner, which is a licensed, have license, would like then go in and do the body massage. However, the lady customer come out and said that, oh, this guy touched my breast. So the owner immediately questioned Tom what was going on. Tom said, I never touched her breast. Anyhow, owner request that Tom bring his body massage to the store. However, later, the phone no longer working. Disconnected. There's no way to reach this guy. Therefore, I think owner would like to say that she did not intend to hire somebody without license. He may have made a mistake that he did not follow up during the section, the massage section, you know, when she need to step in to do body massage. And at this point, that she would like to have opportunity to complete the class. And she's here with me. If you would like her to talk to you in English, I think she made a mistake or something or misunderstanding at the time of vacation about the language requirement, that I sent a letter to reply that she was talking English when she was little. But later on, her English speaking may not be good. Maybe reading, okay. But she could still communicate in English. If you want to talk to her now, she's sitting next to me right now.
If Ms. Wang would like to make a brief statement at this time, you may do so.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Before she starts, without photography, we don't have any indication of who's speaking. So I just wanted to mention that.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
I'm sorry. I make a mistake. I should not trust the Tom. I'm sorry.
Thank you for your statement. Board members, do you have any comments or questions for either the investigator or for Ms. Wang or her counsel? Board member Tapscott?
Yes, this is Board Member Tapscott. This is for Ms. Wang or her counsel. Do we know the last name of Tom?
Yes. The Tom's Chinese name, he told me the Li Ming. And
Li Ming spelled for L-I. First name is M-I-N-G.
So you know his full legal name?
Correct.
And you learned that from his work permit?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. I mean, I have so many concerns about this. I'm sorry, it's not a mistake to let somebody work without a massage license. And that's just a statement. That is a requirement that you get the massage license before they work, just like the work permit that you asked for before they worked. I don't really see a way around that. I don't have any other comments.
Board Member Hefstad, I agree with you also. It is no mistake that somebody has performed a massage without a license.
Even foot massage?
Foot massage is, I mean, we're calling it reflexology. The name of your store is a reflexology business, which is not within the jurisdiction of the massage therapy board. However, it's been noted here that more than a foot massage has been administered, which does require a license.
Understand.
Yeah, this is Board Member Tapscott. I didn't go down that avenue because there was enough concern on this other avenue. But yes, I mean, a full body massage was performed under the pretense of reflexology. The client was asked to lay face down, which is kind of a weird way to start a foot massage, which makes me think that there was an intention of a full body massage. That the client wasn't communicated with. There's admission of guilt. I mean, I could go on and on.
I think the whole situation is that Tom does not speak English, so really don't know what's going on in there, because owner only allow him to do foot massage, not the body massage. But at this point, the owner is aware that something happened there. So, yeah, she apologized for that.
This is Board Member Tapscott. The problem is somebody was violated and somebody is responsible. And it sure isn't the victim. It's definitely the owner and the practitioner who is practicing without a license. I don't see a route. That's not a mistake.
What I'm trying to say, she does not intend to have Tom to work on the body massage, just foot massage only. And later on is because this lady requests combo. So she decided that she would go in to do body massage for her.
That is her explanation.
So that's why her position is not like she intend to hire somebody to work without license. It is her negligence or something or mistake. She's sorry that she's willing to do the joint responsibility.
Thank you for your comment. Vice Chair Moon, do you have anything? Vice Chair Moon, are you with us?
Madam Chair, I have received a text from the Vice Chair. I'm attempting to interpret it. We probably need a confirmation right now if she's in this meeting, and if not, we'll have to suspend until we can locate her.
Okay.
I'll do that while you let me take a moment.
Okay.
I do not see her in the meeting. I tried to raise my hand at the end of the break to say this, and I didn't see her then. So that's how long she's been gone. maybe.
Madam Chair, as best I can interpret the text I've received from the Vice Chair, her departure may be temporary. She's attempting to work on her calendar, but we're really not able to conduct any business at this time. And I don't know if you want to take another 15-minute break.
I think that would be wise. I really want to be able to proceed with this. So let's actually take let's take another 10-minute comfort break and see if she can make it back for when we return.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for your patience. Board staff, I'm apologize. I'm not sure when we started the clock for the 10-minute comfort break.
Chair Ryder, I think it was at, I think it was 12 minutes ago.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for keeping track, Board Member Tapscott. I appreciate that. It seems that we no longer have a quorum and are going to be unable to proceed with the rest of our agenda today. I do apologize to all that are on the call. We will have to recess this meeting until next Monday, July 2nd at 8 a.m. Once again, I offer my sincere apologies to those who are on the call and took the time to come out today. Board Member Tapscott?
I'm so sorry. I don't know why, but what was the date again? I just missed it.
Monday, July 2nd, so that would be next Monday at,
oh.
8 a.m. to complete the agenda.
Monday is July 3rd.
I apologize. Yes.
I apologize. I'm not available that day.
Okay. Do we have, Board Member Tapscott, do you have another date that might work for you?
Yes, ma'am. Monday, July 10th.
Okay. Let me... I could do July 10th, Monday, at 9 a.m. Does that work for you?
Yes.
Okay. Director Augerton,
yes.
Is that going to be possible?
Yes, Madam Chair. What we'll do is we'll repost the continuation of this meeting for that Monday morning at 9 a.m. on the website. And the only thing on the agenda will be two current cases and the remainder of the agenda. So your total time should be less than 60 minutes.
Okay, very good. So, Investigator Elson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Augerton, if we have another case that's ready to go by that meeting, do you want it to go, would it go on the agenda since it's a brand new agenda?
Well, what I had suggested to the chair was to make a motion to recess the current meeting until a later date. And I would defer to our attorneys on the line if we have the ability to amend an agenda that's under recess. I don't believe we do.
I would just go ahead. This meeting would be adjourned for lack of a quorum and then just re-notice a new meeting for the 10th.
Jean, is that you speaking?
Yes, it is. Sorry.
Okay.
Then that is my proposal. I motion that
if I may, you can't motion because we don't have a quorum. So okay. This meeting will just end and staff will re-notice it for July 10th.
Okay, very good. So this meeting is recessed until July 10th at 9 a.m.
It's adjourned, Madam Chair. That's what the attorney is instructing.
Thank you. So it is adjourned until Monday, July 10th at 9 a.m.